Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Canis Albinus,
Makalua,
the main team,
Mega Bears fan.
And welcome to episode 352 of the Polycast. Makalua as usual, and with me is Canis Albinus.
Hello.
Mega Bears fan.
Where's all the eggnog?
Well, yeah, it's like, where's all the rum gone? Because that was what was in the eggnog that was so good.
Oh, it's just the day after Christmas. It's just gone.
And Dan Q keeps haunting us for some reason.
This is hindsight. How's the view?
Oh, yeah, we are in 2020.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, all the hindsight jokes. Just try to get them out of your system now.
Oh, boy. I was hoping it wouldn't come to this. Last year we did say we weren't going to cancel the show, but unfortunately my health has taken a pretty severe hit over the last year, and rather than shut down the entire podcast, we are going to go into a temporary hiatus, probably. I'm not going to go into super detail about what exactly is happening, but the easy way to understand it is my brain is turning to mush. And I am losing the ability to think. And that kind of causes a problem when I'm trying to make entertaining content on the internet. So right now we have a tentative plan to replace me temporarily while things continue, but it is not set in stone yet. We don't know if it's even going to happen. But hopefully, if all goes well, there won't be much of a disruption, but it is very possible that this is the last episode for quite a while. Anything else I need to say?
I think you covered it.
Okay. Oh, I guess that means I have to play the next thing, doesn't it? I'm not here. Or maybe I am and I just don't know it. What the...
It's a little late for Christmas, but we do have a 12 days of Sivmas coming from the Civ Fanatics forums, and I like that our show notes even said no singing on this topic. Thank you.
And then Dan showed up.
Yeah, and then Dan's here. It's like, oh dear.
That was 100% not planned, but it is very funny.
But Victoria started it, and everybody jumped in, and there's a lot of it. We get all the way through it. Got all the way through, and yeah.
And it ended perfectly.
Yes. There was no stumbling over with two people posting at the same time with their number.
That was the most surprising thing for me.
Yeah, because usually in the forums, if you start a sing-along, somebody messes it up midway through.
Yeah. And number one, the final one, was an administrator, so, you know. I wonder if there wasn't some behind-the-scenes thread or post-deleting.
Or closing the thread and then reopening it or something like that. If that's something they can even do, I don't know.
Yeah, they can do that, I'm pretty sure.
They can, yeah.
Okay, so the listing is 12 gunners gunning, 11 barbs raging, 10 warriors rushing, 9 long ships approaching, 8 cities revolting, 7 civs not winning, 6 huts with goodies, 5 warmongers, 4 stolen wonders, 3 capitals fallen, 2 governor promotions, and an expansion pack in the new year.
Well, that would be nice, but we don't know.
I have my theories, but...
Last year, I think we got the announcement around February, right?
We got the announcement at the end of November, or at the beginning of December, one of the two. And it came out in February.
Released in February, that's right.
Yeah. So I don't expect a lot of, what would you call it? Advance notice?
Yeah, they're not obligated to give us any advance notice. They could announce it for tomorrow for all we know.
Right after we record, and then we sound like sillies again.
Yeah. They could do what Pokemon did and just put it on sale immediately and then say that everything's coming later.
That's apparently been a popular thing in the music industry lately. Lots of artists just dropping albums and not telling anybody. Suddenly it's like, oh, there's a new album from like Beyonce or whoever.
I think they're called stealth drops? No.
Yeah, it's a good way to fight leaks, though, for the artists. Because people would leak tracks and half the album would be out and a lot of people might not buy it. So if you just drop it and make everybody buy it first, I mean, it's not going to take long for it leaks onto the internet, but at least you get a bigger initial sales bump.
Might also be an attempt to... Oh, shoot. Brain. Might also be an attempt to... I'm going to shut up.
I think a lot of it's also self-publishing, and that might have been where Canis was going, where the artist gets more of the money and they're not sharing it with the record label. But anyway, this is supposed to be Civ podcast, not music industry podcast. So
music industry / game industry in general podcast.
Yeah, three general comments in response to this thread. The first one is, if an expansion pack were announced tomorrow, the day after a Polycast recording, that would just fit the show's history perfectly, as was kind of already alluded to.
Tradition.
Second, there was one time before on the show where we talked about a Civmas sort of a thing, and that was back in the 2008 Christmas special for Civilization IV, which was a thread from the year before in 2007. And the last thing is, no singing, of course, has been the rule here, and Candace didn't exactly rap, but there are these things called auto-tuners. So don't worry, I'm on it. I'm going to search for one, and I'm going to get some music, a little beatbox going there, and it'll be for reals.
What have I done?
What have you done? Don't encourage Dan to sing.
And bonus, by doing that, we will then be early for Christmas this year in 2020 by a fair bit. We will be ahead of everybody else.
Dan's going to start the new Christmas tradition song, the 364 Days of Christmas.
Oh, now, no.
This is a leap year, so it could even be 366 days.
Oh, yeah. I guess it could
fantastic.
Be. No, it would be 365 because Christmas doesn't count.
Ah, because the rest of the years would be 364, because it's Christmas. That doesn't count.
Actually, that doesn't make sense, because it's the days of Christmas.
Fine, 364 plus days a year. How about that? Well, it's just all-inclusive.
It'll be like 99 bottles of beer on the wall, but with like Christmas tree ornaments or something, or stockings over the mantle.
We've gone off the rails again.
Oh, that's also par for the show. Yeah, well, that's also par for the show.
It's all my fault.
It's all our fault. It always
Whoa, Candace, that's giving yourself way too much power. I don't think we can allow that.
Yeah, I know. I know.
Wow, Dan, wow.
This is where we need a soundboard, and I guess just push the button that makes the Civ Force revolution sound, where it's just the... Yeah.
Yeah. I
well, my brain...
Not a soundboard, but...
Well, that one would work too, but that one's more like somebody if they get burned.
And hey, we did stay on the topic of music and song, so we did not go as off topic as we usually go. So
we were topic adjacent. There you go.
Topic adjacent.
Anyway, our next topic is from somebody who I forgot to look up the thing. Let me open that right now. It's called The Struggle is Real, which is an interesting title for what the topic is, by Andrew Putor.
That's how I read it.
He says, or she has said, I have been playing Civ 6 for a long time, but I can't seem to settle on a particular Civ. And this person is trying to decide which Civ should be their favorite. And they're kind of stuck between the Mongols, the Cree, the Brazilians, the English, and the Dutch. Because he says condition skewed civs aren't as much fun. Geographically skewed civs aren't particularly fun on fractal maps.
And they have Rome in there as well.
Oh, is Rome in there?
Yeah, Victoria and Trajan.
Oh.
Because they're both good for lots of cities.
That would be the they're the same thing, except one is water and one is land.
I'd throw Phoenicia in there, too, as a city-spamming civ, but it's a lot more conditional, so maybe not quite what the original poster was.
Yeah, Phoenicia doesn't really have any land power at all.
Yeah, it depends on the map. But even if you're on Pangaea, that's still a lot of coastline.
Very true. So this kind of devolved into one of those which Civ is the best threads, which is always what happens whenever you talk about things like this. So I decided what she should do is we should choose our own favorite Civs and talk about them. Because apparently, okay, I'm shutting up now.
And I just want to say on the top that this is one of the reasons why I really wish that Fraxis would like put in a feature where you could filter out civilizations that you've already played as or already won the game as when selecting random civs, because sitting there on the game setup screen and scrolling through all the leaders and trying to pick one for my next game is sometimes the hardest part of a game of Civ.
And then right now, if you hit random, you get into the game, and it might be a really good start and map, and then, oh, I'm this person again, or this person, ugh.
Right, and then to add insult to injury, once you've started the game, I don't think there's any way to see the map seed, so you can't then go back out and play the same map.
It might be in the menu. Somewhere in there, I've seen the seed.
It's on the game setup screen. I don't think I've ever seen it on like the pause screen or the options menu.
I think there's a more options setup thing in the pause menu or whatever it's called.
I think that just shows like the pause expansions you have enabled. I didn't think that included the. Maybe I could be wrong. I'll check it next time. Maybe it's there. Maybe they added it at some point.
I could be wrong too.
I like Victoria's comment in the thread where he says, I think it is a credit to Fraxis you are struggling, but perhaps your head says differently. Certainly there is a great variety. And Candace, you had said for us to just, you know, go ahead and choose our favorite civilization. And my favorite, I think, is a very generalist civ for whatever map type you're playing, for whatever victory condition you're going, whatever circumstance you arrive at. And that is Rome. Because if you're starting at the beginning of the game, then you're going to get that monument. If it's a later era start, no. you can get that had to be audible. You can get the equivalent of that for something that's going to give you some culture generation. And quite frankly, I would generalize that even further, that whatever era you're looking to start with, find a civ that has a stronger this, a cheaper that, a unique whatever for that period, and that can give you a very good start. Because after all, and I think this will come up in another topic, and it's been talked about on the show before, that civilization has this way of snowballing, and you want to be the snowball. You do not want to be somewhere along the hill where you're about to get rolled over by that snowball.
Definitely not fun to be run over by a snowball.
Especially when it picks up rocks and ice and, you know, other people. It's just, it just gets really messy. Not that I know anything about that. I'm just saying.
Uh-huh.
I know, it's a very specific denial. That's very suspicious. On purpose.
My favorite is Inca, because the mountains become trivial.
I think that even came up in the thread, and someone had said Inca, and then there was a reply about, oh, there's always the inevitable, but what if I don't have any hills? What if I don't have in the mountains? And it's like, well...
Have you seen a Gathering Storm map? They're there. You just gotta find them.
Yeah, it's true. Most of my games, I feel like I have walled off by mountains on at least one side.
I actually like it better than when in the old games where mountains were just single tiles, peaks that were just completely unsurrounded.
Yeah,
it helps to have actual continent-like chains of mountains.
Yeah, I do, though, think that those whole chains being completely impassable is a bit overboard. They definitely need some kind of like mountain pass terrain feature, something that you can somehow go over. Early in the game, because the huge chains do get kind of ridiculous.
Other than waiting for a military engineer to have the ability to go through the mountain in the later game. Otherwise, oh, by the way, be Inca, and then it's no problem.
And I think I actually tested it, and other civs cannot go through the Inca's unique tunnel. Like, I tried sneaking into one of their cities through one of their tunnels, and it did not work, and I was bummed.
Well, because that totally makes sense. I mean, there's this huge hole in the mountain. It's like, oh, but we didn't build that. I don't know how to walk through that. I don't understand.
Well, it's not as funny as back when you could sail battleships across continents through the tunnels.
Yeah, that was pretty funny. Who needs canals?
This game isn't about realism.
What's realism? We all know that there's big lakes underneath the mountains.
Yeah, I read the Jules Verne book.
Never mind that they're actually make lakes of lava.
I default to the Maori and to Australia a lot, but then I also don't have a lot of games where I go past the middle of the game-ish. I don't go into late game, and I don't know. Australia would still probably be good late game. I don't know if the Maori would be, though.
Australia is definitely pretty good in the late game. Maori kind of drops off as it gets later in the game, but they're still pretty good.
They
have the good snowball start.
Yeah, they're very good when we're doing the multiplayer game, and I know we're not going to, I mean, unless something really goes bad, we're probably not going to get into modern era, so then I have plenty of time to go smack whatever AI I'm supposed to with the Toa, but...
Well, Grim will, but not all of us.
I think the Maori actually do have some late game promise, because if I remember correctly, I think when you get near the point where you can replant forests, you can just start chopping all your forests for the yield and then replant them, and I think you still get like the bonus production or whatever for having the forests in the cities, as well as the like culture or whatever from their unique building. So that that could be a late game boon for the Maori.
The ecologist in me just screamed out in pain.
I know, right? It's just like, one of those
gosh.
Yeah, it's just one of those weird video game things where the game mechanics actually encourage you to do pretty much the exact opposite of what the, you know, flavor theme of the game was intending.
Just like the Civ 4 nuking away enemy population to win the Diplo victory.
No. yeah, right.
Doesn't matter that you guys all voted against me. You've got 15 people in your cities.
But at least unlike the other Civs, the Maori or Maori, I'm not sure how that's supposed to be pronounced, actually do have that incentive to replant the forest. So at least it's, you know, sustainable chopping, I guess.
Sustainable chopping. Well, there is such a thing.
As for me, I do really like the Kree. I think I would probably say that my least favorite civilizations in the game are the very militaristic ones. And that comes in large part because, unlike Phil, who is not here to defend his particular play style today, I don't play super aggressively. And even in the games when, like, I go into the game saying, I'm going to be hyper aggressive, you know, like I'm playing as like Montezuma or somebody, I'm going to be hyper aggressive, I'm going to kill everyone. I just end up not really doing it. I'll like attack one or two civs, and then I fall into turtle and empire building mode, and I just kind of like, oh, I've got a declared friendship. I don't really want to backstab them. So I end up not getting the most out of the militaristic civs' uniques, and it ends up being wasted. So I almost always prefer to have civs that have, you know, good economic or domestic bonuses, especially the ones that apply throughout the entire game, so that I never feel like I'm missing on something if the circumstances of the game or the map just don't allow me to use their, you know, very narrow-windowed uniques.
So to be clear, you're aggressive economically, you're just not aggressive militaristically, but you are also an aggressive player. That's my takeaway from what you just said.
Yeah, sure. I like building cities and districts and all that stuff. I'm like the... You know, it's one of the reasons that I like Civ 6 compared to Civ 5 is that Civ 5 felt very much like a war game where the cities were basically little more than like watchtowers. Whereas Civ 6, especially in vanilla, the expansions definitely made it a lot better. But in Civ 6, it's a lot more of a builder's game. And I like that, even though they could definitely clean up the UI and streamline a lot of things to make the game flow a little bit faster. But I like building. I less enjoy the conquering.
Oh, so you wouldn't like a Gift of Civilization Revolution then? Oh, all right.
Hey, I don't know, maybe. Maybe it'll teach me a thing or two. After playing Bloodborne, I went back to Demon's Souls and Dark Souls and found that I was a lot better at those games because Bloodborne actually taught me how to dodge and parry instead of just stand behind a shield. So, hey, you know, maybe Civ Rev can teach me a thing or two about how to be an aggressive warmonger.
That game really needs to come out on PC.
Yeah, sadly not going to happen. You have to hope for an emulator at some point. I mean,
it is on PlayStation Play, but that would require you to have a PlayStation account.
Yeah, owned by Sony, so don't hold your breath for that one.
Mm-hmm.
Oh well, we get Elden Ring instead, whatever that means.
Yep.
There are a lot of old FromSoft games that we really need to have brought to America, but that's a topic for another discussion.
Oh, speaking of old. Huh? Huh? Segue to the next topic?
Yes, but that would require me to be on the ball.
Those audio cues are actually really helpful because it lets me remember, oh crap, this is my topic. I'd better actually bring up the forum thread about it. I know what I'm supposed to be talking about.
And while Jason does that, I will comment that although Canis was not on the ball, he was ball adjacent. That's the theme of today's episode, adjacencies.
No, the joke was I was on the ball because I had it already pasted in the window, so it was ready to go.
Excellent. Well, it worked out well. So our next topic is, I think, posted by the same user as the previous topic, the Entropootor.
Oh my goodness. The irony.
Yeah. I don't think that was intended, but...
No.
Hooray, you're the Civ Fanatics Forum poster of the week, Entropooter. Congratulations.
Well, seeing as how he just registered his account on the 8th of January and has 6 posts to his name, and we're highlighting 2 of them, he's got a pretty good ratio of getting on the show here. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, I think next week this person will probably be running the show. Who knows? anyway, this post is...
Well, I thought you were going to say he's going to be. I was going to say he's going to be running Civ Fanatics, but I'm like, whoa! Yeah, he's already expanding his reach.
That's what I meant to say, but I slipped.
Anyway, you were answer adjacent. You were answer adjacent.
Yeah, I know.
Okay.
I have just run with it. Anyway, the forum topic here is, are relics worth the effort? And my first comment to that is, well, considering that you get at least some of them for zero effort, because usually the first ones I get come from goody huts. Yep. Yeah, in that sense, they're usually worth the effort because there was no effort. So, but in other cases, you do have to invest quite a bit into them. And Entropooter is basically saying that his or her favorite Civ is Poland for multiple reasons. But one of those reasons is not the bonuses regarding relics, because as he or she says, considering the amount of planning or sheer luck going into a game, are relics worth chasing after if you're going for something other than a tourism religious victory? And then going on to say that they've tried winning tourism victory using relics and appeal alone, but just can't seem to generate enough relics to make it work. And getting unlucky with apostle promotions because they're not able to build Mont Saint Michel. Or they do, and there's just not any enemy religious units in sight. So even though you have all the martyr apostles, there's no one to suicide them against because you can't theological combat against cities for some reason. So yeah, this user is asking other users who play as other civs or as Poland, are the relics worth it? So what does this panel think?
I think, are relics worth chasing after it? It says if you're going for something other than a tourism or religious victory, I would say the answer to that is no, unless you are playing a particular civilization, such as the ones that came up in the thread, which are Khmer, Poland, and Congo, where they can help you towards those victory conditions. But it's not because of the planning and the luck that goes into the game. And of course, we're not just talking about the, oh, hey, I found a goody hut number one. And number two, I was the first into the goody hut. And third, hey, it gave me a relic. Then the answer is no. I personally... And this will probably be the only time this is mentioned in the entire topic, because everyone else is going to roll their eyes if they haven't already, is when I come across a relic and it's early on enough in the game, that base tourism and or faith, if that's going to help me, for instance, get to a pantheon, then fantastic. What I typically will do after that is I would rather offload it onto an AI if it's a single player game, because they will pay a ridiculous amount of money usually for it, and then I just cash that all the way to the bank, and then I put that money into whatever else I want to be doing. So I guess I'm an early antique dealer in the game. That's what it comes down to.
I didn't catch that.
He's a dealer in antiquities.
Oh, exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
So in that sense, the relics are worth it as, you know, gold farms, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you just have to wait for the AI to get to the point where they have a substantial amount of gold. But of course, considering all the bonuses they get, sometimes that happens a lot sooner than you think.
Or alternatively, you can also trade it for other great works. So even if you're not going for a relic specific play, if you do have a civ that has powers oriented towards great works, then, you know, maybe you trade your, you know, apostles' robes or whatever relic you have for, you know, some fancy painting to theme a museum or something later on in the game.
And certainly if you're going for our tourism or religious victory, then that would definitely be something you would want to be doing while all the time cultivating positive diplomatic relationships, so an AI would be interested in doing that. And just as an aside, you may have difficulty doing this in multiplayer. I'm just going to point that out. I know it's a very important topic, a very important consideration to realize that that's not going to be a thing.
In a competitive multiplayer thing, you might as well just sell it to the AI and move on. You're not going to get that.
If there is any AI to be had to sell to, of course.
And I did also post in this thread that I'm pretty sure that if you capture a city that has a relic in it, you do get the relic. So you don't necessarily have to invest in apostles and in getting lucky enough to get the martyr promotion and then finding other civs with inquisitors or whatever for you to throw your apostles at. You could let other civs do all that work and just build military units and then go look for their cities that have relics in them and take those cities by force along with the relic. And now you have a whole butt ton of relics.
What I enjoy most about your comment, Jason, other than but, is the fact that you're talking about people being aggressive and then taking cities, and you just acknowledge that you were in fact not that. So I would very much like to be in a game with you where I can go ahead and do that, and then you can just sit and be aggressive economically. And
I was just trying to make sure that the Phil viewpoint gets presented in this podcast.
Oh, is that what you're trying? Oh, I see. That's what you're trying to accomplish. Oh, okay. Well, why didn't you send me the memo before the show? Why? Why could I have helped
you? But, I was looking at the thread, and I was I had a heart attack because it said, oh, hey, it's 3:06 a.m. when you posted. And then I realized, oh, yeah, he's in the West Coast area.
Oh, he's on the West Coast. They do things differently on the West Coast, you know?
No, Pacific time zone, I mean.
I know. Kmart Elvis in the thread. Wow, Kmart Elvis.
Oh, my goodness.
That's a great username. Just for the record.
Specifically mentioning Congo's unique ability, which, of course, is the +2 food, +2 production, and +4 gold from each relic, artifact, and sculpture. Great work of art, in addition to the usual culture. And they also receive 50% more great writer, artist, musician, and great merchant points. And your palace has slots for 5. That's right, 5 great works, which is fantastic. So, again, kind of tying back to my initial summary answer, which is, no, I don't think relics are worth chasing after if you're going something other than a tourist or religious victory, unless you happen to be a civilization like Congo, because that can help you, you know, you can adapt that to lots of other things. I mean, that could just be good enough for the culture to progress yourself through the civic tree, for goodness sakes, to get to whatever other civic you want to achieve whatever other victory condition it happens to be.
And I would probably also just say that if you're playing as any religious civ, where you are building holy sites and you're building temples and, you know, cathedrals or whatever. Like, if you get them, you know, you might as well keep them. You know, if you have an opportunity to get one, you might as well do it. It's going to be more faith and it's going to be tourism, you know, which is going to be helpful for that religious play anyway.
Yeah, like if you're Russia, for example, and you're already going to get that unique holy site and it's discounted, then it is all the more worth your while to consider that as a possible approach to victory.
Yeah, you don't necessarily need to, like, devote your entire civilization towards getting relics. But, you know, if you don't have to go out of your way to avoid them either.
Yeah, I just went into this goodie hut. I got a relic. Can I put it back? Can I get something else instead? Can I exchange? No. No, you may not.
Can I have faith instead? No, because this isn't Civ 5.
Can I have the Eureka instead?
You could try, if it's single player, you could try reloading the save, but that's going to do you no good.
Well, only if you did not have preserve random seed on. Otherwise, you actually have to, like, wait another turn before entering the goodie hut, and that always opens up the possibility of someone else, you know, just popping out of the fog of war and taking it from. I've had that happen before.
I was about to say, that sounds like personal experience. Do we want a little therapy session here on the show, Jason? Do you need to talk about your feelings about that?
Sometimes save scumming backfires horribly.
Sounds about right.
So what you're saying is you're taking responsibility for your actions. This sounds like personal growth for you.
Oh, I thought it was kids don't save scum.
Now, Mackie, how are kids going to experience personal growth if they too do not save scum? I mean,
there's plenty of things outside of Civ for them to experience. I mean, I know that's a controversial opinion on a podcast all about Civ.
Whoa. I don't think that answer serves our self-interest. So
yeah, we'll be coming back to this idea of save scumming in a bit.
No, we wouldn't be alluding to things we would talk about in another topic on the same show. That sounds like organization. What? And that's effort. Oh, effort with a capital E. That's just too much or not enough.
The world is not enough.
We need more worlds. Oh, wait.
Well, we're gonna save scum with the earth. Hey, let's just hop on a time machine. Let's try this again.
Sometimes I think that might not be a bad idea. And then I remember, oh, wait, we don't really want to do that either.
All right.
That's my cue, Dan.
That's my cue. All right. I was like, I think I'm picking up what's being laid down here. So from Don't Tread, how do you systematically get better? And no, you're still listening to a Civ podcast. We're still talking about the game. We're not talking about your real life. Take it easy. Easy, easy. he says, I have...
I would like to get better as well, but...
Took a moment there. Thank you. I have played Civ since Civ 1 came out. Oh, me too. But I have noticed that after 30 years...
it's been 30 years. I know. I had that thought the other day and went, oh, crap.
Oh, gosh, should I post this thread in my sleep? What's going on? But I've noticed that after 30 years, I'm not really getting better. What are your tips to getting better? I would love to come up with a systematic approach to improving my play. I think there are so many good things in here. But the one thing that really stood out, and it was part of Lowerwind's comment, which was don't worry about mistakes, which ties in part to the save scumming comment. And Jason, I believe you were... in this thread as well, about going over the saves, of course, in a single player mode, trying something different, seeing a different result. But it also came up in the thread, Agnostes, was you don't necessarily have to play the same map, just play with different styles, strategies, tactics, and goals. Try things you've never done before, even if they seem foolhardy, to make efforts to increase your perspectives. And I guess the other general advice I would have about coming with a systematic approach to your play is this is play. This is fun. So find something that is of interest to you. And I actually think you're already on the right path because you asked for advice for what to do. And if we're talking about something more gameplay, that's something else. Gameplay specifically, expand, only build relevant districts and skip the rest. And that's from Elslar. He also talks about abuse what you can by chopping and trading. I see that abuse. That's just having a little bit knowledge of the game mechanics, number one, and also pay attention to the civilization that you're currently playing. They may have an advantage or, in some respects, a disadvantage to what it is that you're trying to do. And refer to that from the beginning to help yourself get better. Have some variety and give yourself time. Give yourself time. I know Don't Tread would say, but Dan, it's already been 30 years. I know. you youngin'.
Well, to be fair, he was probably youngin' when he started too.
Yeah, he's probably, what, like 35 now? So, you know, yeah.
I started playing Civ 3 at 15, but it had already been out for a while by that point.
Was that vanilla Civ 3, or did you have some expansions to go with it?
It was Civ 3 complete. It was 2004.
Oh, there you go. There you go.
That was about when I started, too. It was actually introduced to me by a high school history teacher.
Woo, go teachers.
Actually introduced to the entire class. He actually, like, one of his very first lectures was about, like, you know, where cities would get built. And he used the example of Civilization III and what, you know, you would look for in the game and, you know, how that's similar to real life. You look for water and you look for resources, and that's where you put your cities.
I have never yet won a game of Civ 3, so I didn't play very well. Actually, my first Civ 4 game, I was playing on Settler, and I lost Space Race to have Top Shit. So I've been the whole gamut from really bad to not that bad to a little bit better. I stopped trying to get super good a while ago because I found it was boring. I don't really have a lot of interest in doing a lot of, oh, look, I see that I could increase my or decrease the number of turns I take to get to the end of the game if I do this. Well, that's not important to me because I would rather enjoy the journey rather than enjoy the destination, because the destination is a boring cutscene movie.
And I think, you know, systematically getting better, you could interpret that as how do I get more enjoyment out of the game? So getting better could mean how do I win a victory condition more frequently, or how do I insert your own goal here, which is going to make you want to continue to play the game and enjoy doing it, and then realize that there is a challenge there.
A few years ago, my entire goal with getting better was to not die during the Turncast games.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, and I also posted in this thread, and I think, you know, going back to the previous point of save scumming, is my best advice would be to feel free to experiment. So I have my autosaves set to, like, every two turns. So if something goes awry, I can go back, you know, pretty easily 2, 4, 6, 8, 10 turns, you know, however many, try something different, see if I get a better outcome. And, you know, sometimes even if I fail, you know, I learned, well, that particular thing was not worth the time and investment and risk going for. So in later games, I don't try to do that. You know, like if I'm trying to build a particular wonder and some stupid CPU keeps beating me to it, in future games, I'm just like, eh, I probably not going to bother trying to get that wonder because the AI seemed to prioritize it so much.
2, 4, 6, 8. What do we appreciate? Save scumming.
Oh, no. He did it.
Oh, no. I mean, specifically the no singing was for that specific topic, Anna. So I found the topic.
Oh, crap.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.
I'm going to have to write the whole freaking contract, aren't I?
Bam. Lawyered.
Loopholed.
But yeah, especially for someone coming from Civ 5 to Civ 6, like Civ 5 had a lot of much simpler rules. Civ 6 is considerably more complicated, and there's a lot of like little nuances to so many rules that are very easy to miss, especially if you're used to playing Civ 5 and you're used to the simpler rules. I mean, everything from the way that units move to how Zone of Control works to the concept of like sieging cities and, you know, when to slot in certain policies and you know, slot them out. So a lot of times you just got to figure that stuff out through trial and error. You just got to, you know, I'm about to start a war. I save the game. I fight the war. I get my butt kicked, but I learn a lot about how Zone of Control works. And then I reload at the start of the war. And then I take what I learned and I apply it. And then I win the war. So, you know, there's a lot of that too. You know, trying to figure out, you know, understanding the rules, you know, which seems like it would be an obvious thing, but like I said, there's rules that I still am learning, and you know, I've been playing the game since launch, and I write strategy guides for the dang game, and I'm on a bi-weekly podcast about the game, and I'm still learning rules. So there you go.
They say the day you stop learning is the day you stop dying or stop living, right? Or is that what it is? Is that what they say, or is it that's the day you start dying? I don't remember.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, something like that. And, I mean, this person is asking for advice, and part of the advice, in addition to going onto a Civ forum, is reading blogs like Jason and listening to podcasts like this one. Huh? And finding Let's Plays and finding strategy guides, because there are some things that the game just does not document very well, if at all. Not that we're going to get into that tangent, but there it is.
Do we need another tangent? We've had so many.
Wiki
we have. Also, and I know Jason was trying to bring the aggressive part of Phil's style to play to the podcast on this episode, seeing as how he's not here. I will bring the trolling factor. Canis, you said that you have yet to win a game of Civ 3, right?
Yes.
Have you uninstalled the game?
I have not installed it on this PC.
Well, then you've already won.
Oh.
You're welcome.
The answer about Sim 3.
You're welcome, Phil.
The game of Sim 3.
I agree, Sim 3 is the worst in the series, but I do have some semi-fond memories of playing it.
But let us say it was the least good. How's that?
Yes, there's still a lot of other things you would rather not play than play Sim 3, but you get the bad things stuck in your head. Like, I got through how many hours of this game and I don't have saltpeter, so therefore I can't go forward. I hate you, game.
Well, it was kind of... Yeah,
the three things that Dan said he remembered about Civ 3? Button vomit. If you don't have saltpeter, you're screwed. And something else. Colonies.
Yes, colonies. That is the one legacy of Civ 3 that I think should still be embraced in mainline Civ.
I mean, I think the border growth thing is the main legacy.
Oh, yes, that's still actually in the game, yeah. Because, yeah, Civ 3 was the first to introduce the concept of Civ borders.
Oh, where they expanded by culture?
Yeah.
Yeah. Other mechanics that I miss from Civ 3 is I miss siege units doing collateral damage to cities. Because, you know, Civ 5 and Civ 6, you can just, like, farm experience with your, like, siege units by just bombing a city and then letting it heal because there is no collateral damage. At least Civ 3 put that, like, little bit of pressure where you wanted to capture the city as efficiently as possible, so you still got something that was useful. I actually miss that mechanic. I'm probably in a minority, I know, but I miss it.
That Civ 4 had bombardment of cities that did that too, or was that just for units?
I think it was, I mean, that was just units and maybe
that was units. Yeah.
But like Civ 3, like you could actually destroy a wonder, a world wonder. And you know, that's a that was a pretty huge disincentive to not use your siege weapon more than you absolutely have to.
That would be annoying.
It would be. But then Civ 3 also had a mechanic to deal with that, which was that after a wonder got destroyed or became obsoleted, because that was something that happened in Civ 3 as well, it would become what that game called a tourist attraction, where it just generated like tourist income for the rest of the game, and the income like compounded for each era after either the wonder was built or after the wonder became obsoleted. I don't remember which. So, you know, if you had a city that had a lot of ancient wonders in it and all those wonders get, you know, destroyed by bombardment or became obsolete, that city would get really rich.
Civ 4 had obsoleting wonders, like the Stonehenge used to obsolete a calendar. That was really smart. But
right,
I don't think Civ 5 had obsoleting wonders, did it?
No, and neither did Civ 6. Like, other than like the wonders that just give you a one-time, you know, immediate benefit, I guess those are technically obsolete, but they always provide some heat.
They're not really obsolete because it's not like they take something away after you're done with them.
True.
Yeah, the only real obsolete I can think of is if you start in a later era, then, oh, I'm sorry, this is it's not available if you start in a later era. Which
this
is,
world,
you know,
doesn't have a great library because we started in the ancient, in the medieval era.
Yes, which is another reason why late starts are evil. Wait, huh? Evil, in air quotes.
Yeah.
Is that E-V-I-L?
Yeah.
The Great Library is one of the wonders in Civ 6 that I keep going for and just can never build. Someone always beats me to it.
I think that's the end of that topic.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, then we have to talk about how to analyze your start location. You gotta have some place to start. But Pier 24 started a thread because they need some advice or tips when analyzing start locations. They started as... Oh, yeah. They started... I was like, Teddy, wait a minute. Oh, yeah, Roosevelt, yes. On a fractal map, legendary start, abundant resources. It's got a picture of here. It's like, okay, here's all these places, resource here, resource. Where do I start? That's a nice river. That's a lot of rice.
That's a lot of fish and
yeah.
crabs.
It's a lot of everything.
Yeah, and the thread.
To a wonder.
Yeah, the thread really came down to, in terms of opinions that were expressed, do you settle in place on the deer? Do you settle on the closest rice? And a third distant was, do you settle on that desert hill? And the general consensus was to settle on the closest rice.
Although there are merits to all three courses of action, so I don't think there's any wrong answer in this situation. It kind of just depends on what you want to do. Because even the distant runner-up, which is the settling on the desert, upgrades that tile to being, 2-1 tile? 2 food, 1 production?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, you're getting all those yields from all those other tiles anyway, so if you can upgrade that desert tile and make it, you know, better, that will, you know, help you later on in the game when you actually are working all the tiles. It's just not as much of an early benefit, and, you know, most Civ players tend to favor getting the early benefits rather than, you know, late game benefits because of the snowballing.
Yeah, they want to pack the snowball tight.
Yeah, I mean, the settle in place on the deer, a couple of people were, you know, alluding to, you know, the culture tiles, because we've got that Paiopatai, the natural wonder, and hey, there's that additional culture on the other side. And as came up in the thread, to me, that culture tile on the other side of the wonder are really for another city. I'm quote unquote from Victoria here in the thread. And I think he put it best, what I also think with regards to why to settle on the closest rice, because moving away from the wonder allows more room for you to build districts. You've got that rice for you to have a massive city to build up fast, to churn out settlers and still grow. You've got, you'll have access to the fresh water from the river. And he also talked about the governor Pingala, like having Pingala from the start and just farm the three rice for that pop boost. Because Pingala, the governor, like right away, you're going to get that 15% increase in science and culture generated by this city, and then your city is going to grow, and then you've already got Pingala. Give yourself that first promotion to connoisseur. Now you've got plus one culture per turn for each citizen in the city, and then you can get researcher for plus one science per turn. I know some people might say, Dan, why would you go connoisseur before the researcher? And to me, that's just because you're probably going to be able to get otherwise science generation, more science generation from adjacency bonuses and buildings in your campus district as compared to getting additional culture. So to max out that culture, which then is going to allow you to push farther along the civics tree, and the city is going to grow, so then you're going to get more culture as well, and then more science, and you're just going to be able to put yourself, I think, in a slightly anyway better position than settling in place on the deer. The other advantage, of course, with settling in place on the deer or the closest rice is you're going to be able to settle that first turn, whereas on the desert hill, you're going to have to wait a turn in order to do that. Some people argued about the immediacy of having a harbor there, and I would say, well, settling in place on the deer as well, in addition to the closest rice, you would still be able to get a harbor once you got access to the coast.
And I think some people also brought up the idea of not even committing until you've actually moved that warrior across the river, because there might be really good stuff on the other side of the river that might actually warrant crossing the river and settling on the rice on the opposing side.
That's true. That's true. And that is a good preface to everything that we just said, because that could have changed the dynamic considerably to take advantage of that. I mean, I think Anosti's talked about that on the thread.
I doubt that there's going to be something good enough to warrant spending another turn, because you're going to have to wait a turn to be able to cross the river in order to settle on the other side. So in this case, looking at the screenshot, I would doubt there's something on the other side of the river that would make it worth that extra turn. So you're probably safe just settling on the rice that's adjacent to the settler. But, you know, move the settler across the river, or move the warrior across the river, check it out at the very least. And that's a good idea always. That should always be the first thing you do in any new game of Civ, which is to move your starting warrior to see what is beyond your immediate visibility before committing to settling on a spot.
In a subsequent post from Pure24, he said, A, there ended up being a 16-tile desert to southwest of the mountain, and the desert hills also ended up having iron. But I think even if you knew that from the start of the game, I would still not talk about wanting to settle on the iron, because just again to be able to continue to grow and to settle, we talked about expand and another one, and if you grow, you're going to be able to work that iron tile, you're going to be able to mine that iron, and you're still going to get that.
And building a mine on that iron will give you a Eureka bonus as well, so that will speed along your technological progress.
Yeah, so instead of getting that Eureka bonus from that tribal village you were hoping, and instead you ended up with a relic, you can get it by improving the iron.
And if I remember correctly, I think settling on top of iron does not count as improving it for the purposes of getting the iron-working Eureka.
Yes, I mean, you're going to get the iron right away, but you're not going to have that particular benefit.
Yeah, so you're going to have to spend twice as long researching iron working, which will delay the amount of time before you can upgrade your warriors to swordsmen, which might delay any, you know, classical conquests that you might have planned at that point. Or alternatively, weaken you on the defensive if you're being attacked at that point in the game.
Now, before Oh, go ahead, Maggie.
I was going to say, the internet can't see us nodding.
Yeah, my intention or my first instinct would be to settle on the desert hill, but that's why I'm not as good.
No, I like that too, because you still have all the access to all the nice things there with the rice and the deer and all of your, you don't have to worry so much about your access to the coast, but it does improve that tile. And you could even at that point take one of the rice off that you were originally going to settle on and maybe make the city grow a little bit faster, and you're still going to grow super fast, and you've still got all the forest right there for your early industry.
Yeah, I mean, to what Jason was saying earlier, all three of these choices are good choices. It's just an analysis of what is better / best based on the information that you have at the start of the game.
Yeah,
or the information you've gathered after safe scumming.
Well, that's not the same thing.
Oh man, if we're going to talk about save scumming, let's also talk about using save scumming to unlock achievements and how that's totally legit. Oh wait, we've had so many tangents already on this show. We do not need more. I'm remembering this now. Related to actually...
I have used that tactic, but not on a game like Civ.
Was there another thread that you had as well, Canis, for this episode that also was starting location-based?
Yes, and I got rid of it because I realized it was a picture-based thing.
Which is hard to do in an audio format.
Yeah.
Oh, because you thought we already had the one topic that was kind of picture-based, and that one was even more picture-based?
Yeah, it was basically, is this the worst start you've ever seen? And it was in the ice, on a single ice piece with a mountain blocking any way to go. And there were no resources in sight. So,
well, there were fish and I think copper.
Yeah, there was the fish and the copper. And I guess that we can just kind of maybe generalize that if you are in a start where you're surrounded by some tundra and snow, and clearly you're in the south because we can see impassable terrain there as well, that thanks to a little thing called the governor, specifically with Liang and getting the fisheries there, you would be able to grow that city sufficiently enough. Plus, there was a nice campus spot adjacency there, so you'd be able to get the shipbuilding and find other places to settle, and you would be okay. You'd be okay food-wise, you know, and then the mining-wise. It's okay. It is definitely not the worst start in history.
I think the big complicating factor was that none of the resources that were present were adjacent to where the city would be, so you would have to wait for the city to grow a tile or two before you would even have access to the fish or the copper or any of the other resources or productive tiles. So the only tiles that were immediately workable by the city were the, you know, coastal water tiles, which is like, what, one food, one gold or something like that?
Yeah.
So, it would take forever to get to a place where that city is going to be even remotely productive. On the upside, though, the starting warrior was on the other side of the mountain, so at least that player would be able to explore. I think an even worse start would be if there were two tiles of ice and then a mountain blocking it, and both the settler and the warrior were on one side of the mountain, so you couldn't even explore out beyond your starting location before researching shipbuilding.
That'd be awful.
That would be a quit game, for sure.
Yeah, I guess in that situation, it would have to be, well, A, you're going to need a granary there very quickly, and you're going to want to be buying those hexes, at least one of those hexes that had the fish on it, so you could get your builder out there and start to improve it. It is definitely going to be a bit of an uphill battle, but it's an interesting start. It would be an interesting start to try, and it is not the worst. I guess it becomes the worst start in history if you have a very powerful neighbor adjacent to you with some pretty decent land, and then it might be the worst start in history just because of the context, less about the land itself.
Yeah, especially if Harold of Norway, Phoenicia is your immediate neighbor, and they're going to come at you with a unique naval unit 20 turns into the game.
It might be like, well, I've only got 20 minutes to play Civ before I have to go do something else. Let's see if I can live long enough to that'll be my victory condition there. There's how I systematically improve my play today.
Yeah, and you might want to save scum if you get any goody hut that's not gold, because you're probably going to need a lot of early gold just to buy things like your granary and maybe an early unit or two.
Yeah, or get a builder out there and improve a mine, even though they're and like the one on the copper, for example, because the other advantage, and someone even said, you know what's funny is that in this particular game, you're Nubia. The fact that you are Nubia, though, means that mining-wise, that copper, you would get one more gold for a total of 3 gold, right? Because you get the 2 gold from the copper itself. But because you're Nubia, in addition to the mine giving you that, you will also get additional 2 gold for mine over this luxury resource, which you could then use to start buying those hexes to get the fish.
But of course, on the downside of being Nubia, this player is about as far away from deserts as one could possibly be. So you're not going to get to use your unique improvement anytime soon, if ever, because I think the Nubian pyramid requires being built on a desert. I think.
It does. It's just like, come on, this is just a cold desert instead of a hot desert. Come on now. Oh, fair.
Yeah, in fact, I think technically tundra and deserts, I think, have like pretty much the same definition in some cases. It's, you know, desert is defined as a lack of precipitation. It's something like less than 2 inches a year or something like that. And that, you know, much of the tundra does, I think, fit that definition as well. And so technically is a frozen desert.
Antarctica definitely is. I don't know about the north.
I think a lot of Siberia is technically considered a desert by that definition. And this is the definition that I learned like back in primary school, like 20 years ago. So it could have changed since, I don't know. But that was the definition that I learned.
Definition of desert. Oh, it gave me dessert.
Frozen dessert is I would definitely recommend that. That's that's almost a go-to for dessert.
Yeah. It's not showing me anything useful, dang it. The Antarctic desert and the Arctic desert are the two largest deserts. So yes, you are correct. And the Antarctic desert is only 500,000 square miles larger.
Woohoo! I was factually correct about some things.
Everyone sounds surprised. Jason was correct about some... Oh, wait. Jason's like, oh, and this is, and now I'm remembering why I'm happy Dan's no longer a regular on the show.
This is why we kicked you off the show, Dan.
it's just that one reason, just that one. It was that.
It was
powerful.
Our long con. We set you up with your girlfriend so that you'd marry her and leave the show so that you would stop insulting us.
really, my now wife is in the next room, Jason. We can run that theory by her right now if you'd like. If you think that holds up water, yes? No?
Probably not.
Oh, probably not. Oh, but there is a possibility.
Not definitely
consider
it. Not, but probably not.
Oh, here's my wife right now. So, Allison, there was some conversation that the reason that I'm no longer on the show is because they arranged for us to meet online so that I would then leave and then they could take over. True or false? I don't know how much you people heard that, but apparently this is true. What? Oh,
I'm factually correct about something again.
Yay. Wait, Jason, wait a minute. Why are you surprised by this? You were the one presenting it as fact. Why are you surprised by your fact being a fact? Explain yourself.
I am as surprised as you are.
But you do admit that you are surprised. You should not be surprised at all. Just a minute here. Now, I'm gonna break this language apart right into the ground and grind it up into bits.
Oh, literally, no. Mackie and Phil were the ones conspiring, and I had nothing to do with it.
Okay, so Canis is innocent, and Phil is not here to defend himself. So that's an interesting tactic. It just sounds like you're spinning your wheels now, sir.
It's not even race weekend.
Oh, Jason went silent. He's no longer spinning his wheels. He ran out of gas. Okay.
Just to be clear, car racing.
Yes, I
have run out of witty retorts. So you win this round, Dan.
What else is new? Wait. And when we're saying racing, yes, and racing on a racetrack, we're not talking about racing on roads. That's bad, okay?
Yeah, bad idea.
No hooting around.
Who do I have? Crap.
It's Jason.
Okay, I thought it was me for a second and panicked.
I keep forgetting how long I'm supposed to wait. Thank you for listening to Polycast episode 352. I have been one of your regular co-hosts, Mega Bears Fan, along with Canis Albinus.
We'll be back soon, I promise.
Makalua.
We totally don't conspire for things around here. Nope, don't go on tangents either.
And former co-host, now recurring guest host, Dan Q.
Follow up to something we were talking about earlier. If you mouse over the version of the game that you are running, your in-game, press escape, and you mouse over that, it will give you technical information about the game, including the map and game seed.
Oh, awesome. That's good information. Thank you. Now I don't
keep
taking screenshots of the setup screen every time I start a new game in case I do want to reload that.
Yeah, that's just the value I add to this show. Don't you forget it.
Oh, boy.
So, does that mean you have to pay the value-added tax? We don't have one of those here, thank goodness.
Oh no, but now I've somehow given you the idea. I'm immune from this, I'm grandfathered in. Not to say that I'm old, although I guess I kind of technically did say that.
Yeah, you kind of just did, yeah.
But you know what? It serves my purpose right now, so, yeah. You hear that, you whippersnappers?
That's right, us whippersnappers.
Okay, old man.
Yeah, okay, old lady.
Sure, I'm not sure if being grandfathered out of paying taxes is a thing.
Jason, we already know that you're having difficulty establishing fact from fiction, so it's just one of those things we'll work through.
I seem to recall a famous saying about taxes being one of the two certainties of life.
Yes, and there's always ways to get out of paying those taxes. That's part of the quote.
I got to call the Canadian Revenue Agency.
Yeah, I know, right?
What's the bounty for reporting tax fraud to the KC, whatever it is?
Well, 1,867 ducats.
Way
strangely specific.
And if anyone can figure out why I specifically said 1,867, I will give you an internet cookie.
Well, it's the year of Confederation, of course.
Where's his cookie?
Civilization 4, 5, Beyond Earth, and 6, Sound Clips, Copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright the Polycast at thepolycast.net.